Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We had yesterday got up to about text 48, I think, or so, having been through Devi Dham, Mahesh Dham, Hari Dham. We talked a bit about Sheshanag, text 47. He is providing the accommodating feature of the material nature, the all-accommodating potency. In this way, he is continuing to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he is a form of Lord Govinda. Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Then let us recite responsively text 48. Yasyai kanishvasita kalam atavalambya. Jivanti loma vilaja jagadandanata. Vishnur mahansa iha yasya kalavishesho. Govindam adi purusham tamaham bhajami. Brahma and other lords of the mundane worlds, appearing from the pores of here of Mahavishnu, remain alive as long as the duration of one exhalation of the latter, Mahavishnu. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, of whose subjective personality Mahavishnu is the portion of portion. Here Srila Bhaktisiddhanta makes a very brief comment. The supreme majesty of the subjective nature of Vishnu is shown here. Well, of course, the supreme majesty of Lord Govinda is shown here, and of course Mahavishnu, his majesty, is also shown. That Lord Brahma, he's so great, he lives for 311 trillion, 40 billion of our years. So, by our standards, practically he's eternal. And he's so powerful, we may struggle to create some small thing, some very intelligent and enterprising and powerful person may create an empire for a few years on this planet. But Lord Brahma can create the entire universe, and it's always totally under his control. So what a person Lord Brahma is. He's so great. But that period of time, his whole lifetime, 311 trillion of our years, such a long time, and so many things happen, and it's all under Lord Brahma, and he's got it completely under control. But in terms of Mahavishnu, it's the period of time of his one exhalation and inhalation. Just think if there was some little insect in front of you and you exhale and inhale, and that's his entire lifetime finished. He did everything in that period. He was born. He grew up. He went to school. He got married. He had a family and worked hard and then retired and then got old and then died. In that time that we exhaled and then inhaled. So he did all those things. How significant would we think that creature was? Not very significant. But that is Lord Brahma. That is Lord Brahma. So what to speak of us? We are rather pathetic little creatures. Srila Prabhupada, somewhere I think it's in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, refers to us as forgotten souls. Just, you know, don't worry about them, forget them. Yeah. So what about us? If Lord Brahma is that insignificant compared to Mahavishnu, then what about us? We are practically out of the reckoning altogether. We really don't count. But then, Vishnur Mahan Saiha Yasya Kalavisheshu. That Mahavishnu is a part of a part of Krishna. Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. So in this way, the supreme majesty of the subjective nature of Vishnu is shown, and even more so, the supreme majesty of Govinda, the original Adipurush, is shown there very vividly. So then Lord Brahma goes on in text 49 to talk about himself or those who are in the post of Brahma, what it means to be in the post of Brahma. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, from whom the separated subjective portion Brahma receives his power for the regulation of the mundane world, just as the sun manifests some portion of his own light in all the effulgent gems that bear the names of Suryakanta. So there is a gem called Suryakanta, and somehow or other it stores the power of the sun, something like that. Little bit of the power of the sun. And so in this way it can burn something perhaps, because it stored a little bit of the power of the sun. Just like some days when it's really hot, if you take a black piece of rock, flat rock, and put it in the sun, if it's really hot, by that I mean if it gets up to about 50 and it's a very bright sunny day, so you leave that rock in the sun for some hours, then you may be able to cook a chapati on it or something like that. You can certainly burn yourself. Yes, in some places in New Zealand where I'm from, they have some beaches which have black sand. It's completely black. And when it's a hot day and you walk on that sand, then you can get blisters on your feet. I mean, you can't even walk. You can hardly run. I mean, it's just too much, the heat. So the thing is that the sun is imparting its potency to different things, like the Suryakanta gem, or like some item you may place in the sun. But the difference between the potency of the actual sun and the amount of that potency which is imparted to that object, even though that object may reflect the potency of the sun quite noticeably by our standards, but compared to the sun it's nothing. So like that, Brahma is saying that all the Brahmas receive their power for regulating the universe from Krishna. It's not their own independent power. They receive that power from Krishna, but it's a tiny, tiny little part of the actual power that Krishna has. Just like Krishna says at the end of the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, by a single fragment of myself, I maintain and sustain the entire creation. So this is the principle involved here. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta in the purport discusses, in terms of something we were talking about briefly yesterday, how by principle Brahma is superior to ordinary jivas, but is not the direct divinity. The divine nature is present in a greater measure in Shambhu than in Brahma. So Lord Shiva is higher than Lord Brahma. The fundamental significance of the above is that the aggregate of 50 attributes belonging to the jivas are present in a fuller measure in Brahma, who possesses in a lesser degree 5 more attributes, which are not found in jivas, but in Shambhu. Both the 50 attributes of the jivas, as well as the 5 additional attributes found in Brahma, are present in an even greater degree than in Brahma. So I just looked up those different attributes. I thought we could just mention them. So all living entities have the first 50. Of course, the jivas have in a minute degree, and Krishna has completely. Brahma and Shiva partially have 5 more. Partially, they have 5 more. Changeless, all cognizant, ever fresh, Satchit Ananda body, and all mystic powers. But partially, they're partially changeless, partially all cognizant, partially ever fresh. They partially have Satchit Ananda Vigraha, Satchit Ananda bodies, and they partially have all mystic power. Not on the same level as Krishna, not even as Lord Narayan. Then Lord Narayan has another 5. He has inconceivable potency. Uncountable universes come from his body. He is the original source of all incarnations. He is the giver of salvation to the demons he kills. And he can attract liberated souls. So these are special characteristics possessed by these special persons. And Brahma is actually so special that at the beginning of the purport, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta makes the point that generally, Lord Brahma is a jiva, some eligible jiva. But sometimes there is no eligible jiva. So then Krishna incarnates, an avatar appears and takes the position of Lord Brahma. So this position of being Brahma is very important. But anyway, one way or the other, his power, his extreme power, is just a little reflection or just a little particle of the power of Krishna. Then next is Ganesh. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, whose lotus feet are always held by Ganesh, upon the pair of tumuli protruding from his elephant head, in order to obtain power for his function of destroying all the obstacles on the path of progress of the 3 worlds. So he, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says, he is amongst the 5 gods who are particularly important for helping conditioned souls, on the material level. Those 5 are Vishnu, Ganesh, Shiva, Durga, and Surya. And they're actually going to be mentioned again in a couple of verses. So they're called, well, the worship of them is called Panch Upasana. And they're particularly prominent deities within the material world. Ganesh, Shiva, Durga, Surya, and Vishnu. And Ganesh, his particular function, he's very important because he removes obstacles. You may recall that in Nectar of Devotion, there is one principle in chapter 6, is it? I think it's chapter 6, which describes 64 things that we're meant to do in devotional service. So one of them is we're meant to worship Ganesh. At least that's what Rupa Goswami said. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada never instituted that. Otherwise, we would be doing it today. And I've never heard of anyone doing it, in ISKCON at least. But I've definitely heard of people asking Prabhupada if they could, and if they could, how would they do it? And Prabhupada responded that it's very difficult. Don't get into it. It's very, very difficult. It's so difficult and demanding, and it has to be done under the strict supervision of the spiritual master, and so on and so forth. And the devotee wrote back and said, well, you know, I might like to have a go, so can you tell me what are the requirements? And Prabhupada wrote again and said, yes. First thing is you need to give Dakshin, Guru Dakshin, minimum $100,000 a month. In other words, this is quite a big thing we're thinking of getting involved in here. So we don't do it. And an interesting point is, and actually it's a very essential point, is that Ganesh is holding the lotus feet of the Lord on his head, and in that way he's getting the potency to remove the obstacles. It's not that he's independently powerful and he doesn't see himself as such. And actually what Ganesh is doing, he is always chanting mantras to and performing puja to Lord Nrisingadev. Ganesh is a great devotee of Lord Nrisingadev. And here where it says that he's always holding the lotus feet of Lord Govinda on his head, in order to get that power to remove the obstacles. In specific terms, we understand that this is indicating Lord Nrisingadev. This is really referring to Lord Nrisingadev, that particular form of Lord Govinda. So if we want obstacles to be removed, if we would like to get this facility which Ganesh is offering, then really all we have to do is worship Lord Nrisingadev. And that is like the direct approach. And we're doing that. So in this way, what is being described here in text 50, or the benefits being described, are obtained by the devotees. All his glory rests entirely on the grace of Govinda, or Lord Nrisingadev. Then text 51. The three worlds are composed of the nine elements, fire, earth, ether, water, air, direction, time, soul, and mind. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, from whom they originate, in whom they exist, and into whom they enter at the time of the universal cataclysm. Anyway, I think that's fairly clear. The elements, whatever there is within the material world, there are different ways of looking at it. Here, it's being looked at in nine features. If you look in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where is it? Is it verses 6 and 7, I think? 6 and 7. There's a little bit different way of looking at the same thing. All the ingredients which make up the material nature. There's a list I think it's 24, if I'm not mistaken, ingredients, including the senses, different types of senses. There are different ways of looking at the makeup of the material nature, but the bottom line, as expressed here, is that it's all coming from Lord Govinda, and it's all originating in him, it's all being sustained by him when it's manifest, and when everything is withdrawn, it's all going back into him, so he is the ultimate factor within the material nature, or behind the material nature. Text 52 is discussing the last of these five deities, these five important gods, Vishnu, Ganesh, Durga, Surya, and Shiva. They've all been discussed now. In other words, these five are very important. So now the sun god in text 52 is being briefly described. The sun, who's the king of all the planets, full of infinite effulgence, the image of the good soul, is as the eye of this world. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, in pursuance of whose order the sun performs his journey, mounting the wheel of time. The sun is sometimes taken to be, different people have different views on the demigods. Some look on Durga as being supreme, some look on Shiva as being supreme, and some look on the sun or the sun god as being supreme. And indeed, sometimes he's referred to as Surya Narayan. He's a specially empowered personality. He's very, very, very important. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta in the purport, he explains why some people think that the sun is uniquely important. He says certain professors of the Vedic religion worship the sun as Brahman, or in other words, as the supreme. The sun is one of the hierarchy of the five gods. We mentioned that. Some people target in heat the source of this world, and therefore designate the sun, the only location of heat, as the root cause of this world. If the sun were to be turned off today, and from now on there were to be no sun, we would all die before long, and all living entities would die. That would be that. Because everything, all life on the material level, is being sustained by the sun, through photosynthesis. All the plants and so on are able to develop. That's from the sun. So if the sun was withdrawn, all the plants would die, all the animals would die, all the humans would die. So therefore some people take it that the sun is supreme. However, the sun is getting his potency from Govinda. Not only is he getting his potency from, but he's acting under the order of Govinda. There are verses in the Upanishads or the four Vedas saying that out of the fear of Lord Narayan, the wind is blowing, the sun is shining, the planets are staying in their orbits. So all of these things, including the sun, are dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But the sun is particularly important. There is a practice, I believe, in India. Those of you who are from India could correct me if I'm wrong. That if someone has some serious disease and they cannot be cured by, they have not been cured so far by whatever medical attention it was possible to give them, and then the doctors run out of, possible solutions and they give up, then there is an approach, I have been told, of just putting the person in the sun. Have you heard of that? If all else fails, put him in the sun. Because the sun is the ultimate sustaining Where did I hear that from? I heard that from someone. I forget exactly. But if all else fails, put him in the sun, and that's like the last hope. So that's the end of that section, which was about how Krishna is the supreme lord of all lords, of all the presiding deities and so on, who are very important in their own rights and in many cases seem to be supreme. But actually he is the supreme and he's sustaining them. So that brings us on to the next section. Text 53 and 54, and even text 55 can be included, really. Although in our overview book we've said that 55, I think, is kind of in a separate subsection, but really, they do fit together. There's a natural progression in the subject matters from 53 to 54 and then to 55. The progression basically is, well, let us read through the verses. I'll read through all three of them and then we'll see how there is this natural progression. So 53, I adore the primeval Lord Govinda by whose conferred power are maintained the manifested potencies that are found to exist of all virtues, all vices, the Vedas, the penances, and all jivas from Brahma to the meanest insect. In other words, whatever is maintaining anyone in the material world is coming from Govinda. And particularly he's referring to the human species, although certainly not entirely, but he is saying that Govinda is giving the potencies that are found in all virtues. This is actually how he's translated the word dharma. So all the valuable results that can be achieved through dharma, they're coming by the potency of the Supreme Lord. All the potency that is there in sin to drag a person down is coming from the Supreme Lord. All the potencies which are there in the Vedas. If you follow the Vedas, then your life will develop. So that potency to enhance your life and improve your life, if you follow the Vedas, that potency in the Vedas is from the Supreme Lord. Then the potency in penances. If you get into the practice of performing austerity, something like this, taking vows to achieve goals. Well, there's so many examples of that. A person wants to achieve a goal, so they take a vow that for the next year, I will not do this, or I will do that. So all these different, so many different types of penances are there, and, you know, there's pious penances, there's impious penances, like what Hiranyakashipu did. So there are all these different types of penances, and there is potency within them. And as a result of that potency, sometimes the people who perform them achieve some high goal, like Hiranyakashipu did. So the potency there is coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So generally this verse then is addressing human society. But actually it applies, Lord Brahma says, to all living entities. From himself, from Brahma, down to the Kita Pataga, the meanest insect. Perhaps that is species 8 million. 400,000. Lord Brahma is species number one. So then you go down through the human species, down, till you get to species number 8,400,000. And I think that may be, the actual species I think may be mentioned in text 54. I'll read text 54. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who burns up to their roots all fruitive activities of those who are imbued with devotion, and impartially ordains for each the due enjoyment of the fruits of one's activities, of all those who walk in the path of work, in accordance with the chain of their previously performed works. No less in the case of the tiny insect that bears the name of Indragopa than in that of Indra, king of the Devas. So in text 53, we heard how the Supreme Lord is providing the potency which is there in so many activities, generally for upliftment, although sin was also mentioned. Anyway, all the potencies which can change people's positions, up or down, they're coming from Govinda. Now here, it's being particularly applied to the devotees, plus the karmis. Yes, the devotees, by the mercy of Lord Govinda, they can achieve perfection, and by the mercy of Lord Govinda, the karmis get whatever they deserve. From Indra this time, Indra is like one step down from Lord Brahma in the hierarchy of living entities. He is the chief person beneath Brahma, Shiva and Vishnu. Next one is Indra. And then it appears that species number 8,400,000 may be the Indragopa germ. It is being suggested, so that would seem to indicate it could well be the very lowest. So that's pretty low. Probably some unicellular little bacteria or something like that called the Indragopa germ. So just think, if you ever feel that perhaps I'm the lowest of the low, then, you know, to be the lowest of the low is pretty low. You have to be as low as an Indragopa germ. And I don't think we could really conceive of how low that is. It, I think, is beyond our capacity. Just as for us to imagine how great is Brahma and what it would be like to be Brahma, I think it's beyond us. So I think it's also beyond us to imagine what it would be like to be the lowest of the low. In other words, to be an Indragopa germ. But anyway, he is getting what he deserves. There's one famous story in which one devotee came to Srila Prabhupada and tried to express a mood of humility, telling Srila Prabhupada that, Srila Prabhupada, I'm so low. I'm the lowest. I'm the most fallen. I'm just like that, the worst. Srila Prabhupada's response, because he could see that, you know, this devotee doesn't really have a clear conception of what it means, in fact. So Prabhupada said to him, actually, you are, the devotee had said, I'm the most fallen, the most fallen, the most wretched. Prabhupada said, you are not the most anything. You are simply insignificant. Anyway, there is this Indragopa germ, and he really is small time. But even he is directly under the control of the Supreme Lord, who's working through this system called karma, being administrated by the demigods. And even the Indragopa germ, every millimeter of its existence is being controlled through the system of karma. And then text 55. So we saw from 53 was talking about how people's positions may change. 54 is talking particularly about the devotees, really. And when we look at it a little more closely, we'll see that he makes a distinction between how the Lord deals with the devotees and how the Lord deals with the karmis. in terms of change of position. Then 55 is talking about specifically the devotees and the process, how they become elevated and achieve perfection. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, the meditators of whom, by meditating upon him under the sway of wrath, amorous passion, natural friendly love, fear, parental affection, delusion, reverence and willing service, attain to bodily forms befitting the nature of their contemplation. So, different people, of course they're not all devotees, but they're all Krishna conscious. So different people achieve different goals in terms of the specific natures of their Krishna consciousness. So here we've gone from all living entities, just going up and down in different ways, to the devotees and the karmis specifically, but particularly the devotees. And then in 55, how people who focus on Krishna achieve different goals in Krishna. So, let's see now. 53, what should we add about that? What should we add about 53? Well, I think it's fairly straightforward, really. He talks about dharma means vanashram. This is a very popular subject. It has been for some years in ISKCON, although I don't know if we've made a lot of headway in coming to grips with it. But anyway, I think we all know it's a pretty popular subject, and we would like to make headway with it, and I guess sooner or later we will. But anyway, it's the Lord's system. And there's special potency in it, if it's followed properly. First of all, it has to be Krishna conscious. It's not just a matter of just do what you feel like, you know, do whatever comes to you in terms of your material nature. It has to be Krishna conscious. If it's not Krishna conscious, even if you're doing your varna and ashram duty in the most wonderful way and you just fit into it, just like a hand may fit into a glove, but it's not Krishna conscious, then it won't work. To the point that Lord Chaitanya says to Sanatan Goswami in Madhyalila, chapter 22, the followers of the Varnashram institution accept the regulative principles of the four social orders and four spiritual orders, the Varnas and the Ashrams. However, if one carries out the regulative principles of these orders, but does not render transcendental service to Krishna, he falls into the hellish condition of material life. Yes, so it has to be Krishna conscious. Yeah. Otherwise you'll fall down into a hellish condition. Anyway, then on to 54. Particularly in the purport, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta is making a distinction between the devotees and even the karmis, meaning the pious fruit of workers who are following the Vedas and doing all the right things on the material platform. There's a big difference. The pious fruit of workers, they all get exactly what they deserve, mechanically, according to the laws of karma. There's no special mercy. In other words, if a karmi, a complete karmi, is hoping to get a lot of money, if it's not his karma, he won't. And praying for it won't help his chances of getting it. Whatever's going to come, will come. But for the devotees, it's different. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta explains this in a very nice way, interesting way actually. Let us read a little bit from the purport, from the beginning of the purport. God impartially induces the fallen souls to act in the way that is consequent on the deeds of their previous births. So if you follow what that means, it's like Lord Brahma when he took birth, he just felt like creating. Why did he feel like creating? Because in his previous lifetime, he had cultivated that nature. And so in the next lifetime, now as Lord Brahma, he had that nature. In a sense, it's like when you go to bed at night, you wake up the next morning, then you have the same nature that you had yesterday, isn't it? It's not that just because you slept a few hours, now you've become a different person. Not at all. So similarly, from one life to another, it's like that. It's like that. It's a continuum from one life to another. So they act in a way which is consequent on the deeds of their previous births, and they enjoy the fruition of their labors. They get what they deserve. But out of his great mercy to his devotees, he purges out by the fire of ordeal the root of all karma, that is, nescience and evil desires. So watch out. You may have to undergo a few ordeals. Elsewhere, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, that as gold is purified by fire, as sugar cane is purified by fire, so the devotee is purified by the fire of ordeal. In other words, we can expect some tests. But if we learn how to depend on Krishna and take shelter of Krishna, then those tests will not just be like some heavy experience which just comes smashing onto our heads. But we'll be able to see Krishna in those tests. And in this way we can advance through the tests and become purified through the tests. Yes. And, you know, you might say, well, look, I'd rather not have to go through it, thanks. If you don't mind. I'd rather do without this fire of ordeal, so therefore I think I'll just opt for not being a devotee. Then you have to undertake the ordeal of going through all this birth, death, old age and disease. So actually it's better to go through the fire of ordeal of Krishna testing you and purifying you and pushing you, come on, come on. Move forward. Give up some of your attachments. Better to go through that. And there's a really nice verse. Some of you may know it. There's a really nice verse spoken by Queen Kunti in which she expresses her realization, and she's got exactly the right realization. This is Srimad Bhagavatam 1.8.25. It's a really classic verse. Vipada santuta shashvat tatra tatra jagad guru bhavato darshanam yatsyad apunar bhava darshanam. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we'll no longer see repeated births and deaths. This verse is referred to in Preeti Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami as an example of a devotee, or like she's displaying symptoms of a devotee on the level of rag. Rag is a stage of prema. Prema, there are different levels within prema, beginning with, so to speak, just prema, if you could say that. Simple prema. That's not so simple either, at all. But from simple prema up to the level of mahabhava, there are several stages, and one of them, somewhere in the middle, is rag. And a symptom of rag, rag means intense attachment to Krishna. A symptom is that whatever will please Krishna, you will do. Even if it means displeasure for you, but the fact that it pleases Krishna that is such a powerful impetus that you will totally overlook the fact that it may be detrimental to you. Totally overlook. It'll not even be a consideration. And even if pleasing Krishna involves something which is painful for you, then you look forward. Yes, let me suffer. This is not masochism or self-sadism or whatever the term may be. This is not that. Yes. So, Queen Kundi's had this experience. She's speaking this verse immediately after the Battle of Kurukshetra, like a couple of days after. They've undergone so many difficulties, incredible difficulties. And all those difficulties have just been solved completely. The battle has been won. It's all over. All their enemies are dead. The whole world is theirs. That's it. They have achieved practically absolute success. But what is she saying? I wish those calamities would happen again and again. I want them to happen again. Because she knew that when they were in exile and undergoing so many difficulties, then some problem would come and they would call out, "Oh, Krishna, help!" And Krishna would be there. And when Krishna was there in front of their eyes, that was so wonderful. Then whatever the calamity was which stimulated them to call for Krishna, oh, they just forgot about that. Didn't matter, because now we have Krishna. Oh, it's just, they just go totally beyond all these things. So now she's worried. We have all these facilities at our disposal. What's going to happen to us? We may forget Krishna. And when we forget Krishna, it hurts. But when Krishna is there, it's so wonderful. So how can we have a situation in which Krishna will always be there? We need calamity. So, let all those calamities come again and again. Please, bring on the difficulties. This is a very high level of consciousness. And this is not a form of sadism upon oneself. This is a very high level of God consciousness. And through all those trials and tribulations, of course, I mean, they were already purified, but they were showing us, they're pure devotees, so they're showing us how, in this difficult material world, we're all going to go through difficulties in one way or another. So they're showing us how pure devotees go through difficulties, but don't become bewildered. They always remain surrendered to Krishna. And as a result, everything works out, and pure Krishna consciousness is there, and Krishna is there. So in this way, we can see how to act when we are in this fire of ordeal, which Srila Bhaktisiddhanta is talking about here as being kind of implicit in the way of life of a devotee. Just like we went to Nandagram today and we gave the devotees an option. Either you walk out through the, you know, really wet and muddy and slippery and dangerous fields and take some risk there, or you go up to the temple and take the risk of being harassed by the pandas. So which risk would you like? So we all went out to Tirukadamba anyway. Can anyone else think of an example of someone who went through the fire of ordeal and it helped them? I'm thinking of someone who we are talking about perhaps recently in Srimad Bhagavatam class here. Bali Maharaj, what an ordeal. from king of the entire universe to having everything taken away in the space of about 2 seconds, to then immediately being arrested and condemned to hell. How's that for a trial, a test? That's quite a test. But he surrendered. He took the test in a very humble way. He didn't get uptight and call foul. He broke the rules or something. He didn't take Shukracharya's advice and try to cheat his way out. He just took it. So, like this, through the fire of ordeal, Krishna purifies the devotees, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta goes on to say that those who are, this is at the bottom of page 99, those who are pure devotees always serve Krishna by gratifying his senses, forsaking all attempts of karma and jnana, and being free from all desires save that of serving Krishna. Krishna has fully destroyed the karma, its desires and nescience of those devotees. It is a great wonder that Krishna, being impartial, is fully partial to his devotees. That was the bottom of page 99 over to the top of page 100. So just see, the karmis are getting what they deserve every inch of the way, from Indra down to the Indragopa germ. But the devotees, because they're surrendering and undergoing all these trials and tribulations and taking shelter of Krishna more and more, he gives them more and more mercy. So it is a great wonder that Krishna, being impartial, is fully partial to his devotees. So we'll talk a little bit about 55 tomorrow and 56 also. 55 is the last of the Govindam Adipurusham verses. Any comments or questions? Like an Achintya Beda Beda idea, how could Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma be partially all cognizant, partially ever fresh, or partially, what is it, partially have such at ananda bodies? Yeah. You know, I think the essence of the answer is found in the second canto, where Narada Muni is questioning Lord Brahma, that as I thought you were supreme. You live so long, you live eternally, isn't it? It appears to Narada Muni. But now Narada says, now I see you're worshipping someone else. So is there someone beyond you? So then Lord Brahma goes on to explain. So Prabhupada there explains about the body, his body, Brahma's body. Brahma lives for 311 trillion 40 billion of our years. So that is finite. It is not eternal. But by our standards, there's one purport Prabhupada discusses this there. I think it may be the 8th chapter or maybe the 9th chapter of the 2nd canto, somewhere around there. So Prabhupada says, even though it is finite, but from our perspective, it's intangible. You know, like, I think we may have mentioned this earlier. We can conceive, particularly if you've been around about 50 years, then you can conceive what it's like to live a lifetime. Even though a lifetime is longer, you know, maybe 80 years. You know, there's some idea of the temporary nature of it. But when the child is 5 or 10, then there, at least in my own experience, there's no clear conception at all that all of this is going to end and I better watch out. It's just like this open thing. It's just going to go on. Because from that perspective, by the standards of that child, he has no sort of yardstick or anything to measure it by. So it seems like that. But, you know, at a certain point it becomes. You realize that, you know, I only have so many years to go, and it is quite finite. So when we, from our perspective, look at 311 trillion, 40 billion years, it's completely meaningless to us. It's just going to go on and on and on and on. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada says that in a certain sense, from our perspective, Brahma could be considered eternal. In a certain sense. So I take it in that way. I take it in that way. You know, certainly they are partially all cognizant, in that they are definitely cognizant of all the living entities in the material, in their particular universe. So they're definitely partially all cognizant in terms of their specific parameters. Changeless. Well, they're partially changeless because, you know, by the time we have gone from being one day old to the point where at perhaps 70 or 80 years, by the law of averages at least, we may then leave our what will be a totally decrepit and wiped out body. If we were to, you know, have had a look at Lord Brahma on day one, and then have a look at Lord Brahma on our last day, then we would not be able to discern a change. Because for him, it's been just a few seconds. Yeah. So no discernible change will have occurred. Actually, some change will have occurred, but it won't be discernible. So in that sense, he's partially changeless. In a certain, you know, it's a very achintya-bade-abade type of understanding. So I take it like that. They partially possess all mystic powers. Well, they do. They have tremendous mystic powers. They have all of them, but not completely. Yeah. That's my understanding. Is it correct to assume that Krishna has cognizance over all the universes? Definitely. And every atom within them. Yeah? No. Brahma and Shiva are conscious within their own universes. Yeah. They're very conscious. They're very high living entities. Correctly can mean through his energies. Yeah. He is expanded through his energies, and he deputes his potency to his energies. So there's a sense of difference there. Yeah. So in that sense, it could be said directly and indirectly. Yeah. So please, if you haven't read verse 55 and the purport, please read it. It's a little involved. It's very interesting though. And then 56, we'll also discuss tomorrow, verse 56. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.